Hey, Fringe Voices Show listeners, I'm back from a long break and will be making more regular episodes again. Today I wanted to talk with a special guest about democratic socialism, so enjoy the show. Before we jump into this episode, this is James from Fringe Voices. I just wanted to let you know about Anchor. Anchor is the easiest way to make a podcast. It's free. And they have plenty of tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. In addition, Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more places. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to Anchor, ANCHOR.FM to get started. Thank you. All right. Today we welcome Micah Utrecht, who is the deputy editor of Jacobin and host of Jacobin Radio's podcast, The Vast Majority. He is also the author of Strike for America, Chicago Teachers Against Austerity, and co-author of Bigger Than Bernie, How We Go From the Sanders Campaign to Democratic Socialism. So how are you doing today, Micah?
All things considered, given that the world is the worst it's been in a very long time, I'm pretty good.
That's good. Yeah, that's a positive answer to, especially what's going on right now with everything, right? And one of the reasons of why I wanted to bring you on is because I think that there are some, as you would probably agree with, some practical solutions to what ails, especially the U.S. right now, maybe not in terms of just like the virus, but in terms of other things like the economy and businesses and things like that. So I wanted to start off by just introducing people to what you're thinking democratic socialism is, and like, how would you explain it to a moderate Democrat or moderate Republican?
Sure. So the basic idea about democratic socialism is that it's about democracy, and that we're about expanding democracy into spheres where it doesn't already exist and deepening it in spheres where it already does exist. So that means in terms of expanding into new spheres, we think that it's a matter of basic democracy, who has the resources in society, who is able to provide for themselves, and be comfortable and have the things that they need, and who is not. And so we believe in making goods public whenever possible, especially essential goods like housing and education, also like basic things about luxury. Like, we should all have public goods like public parks that are really well funded, that we get to share together as a public, as a sort of social collective. And we also believe in expanding political democracy. I mean, expanding voting rights, spreading democracy to workplaces, which is the place where most of us spend the majority of our waking hours, and do that through unionization and through giving workers a job, a voice on the job, where currently bosses get to act essentially like authoritarian petty dictators. So in short, the democratic socialist vision is one that is about expanding democracy really providing people with the most basic things that they need in order to live, full and fulfilling and flourishing lives.
I mean, to me, these all sound like positive things, right? So why do you think that democratic socialism gets such a bad rap, and why do you think people would be against some of these things that you speak about, I just don't understand why someone would be against like public education, would be against public housing and things of that nature.
Yeah, well, you would have to ask the enemies of such goods why. I mean, those all sound like good things in the abstract, right? And I believe that they are. But to get those things, to get goods that benefit the vast majority of people in the world, that means that you have to not have those resources all concentrated in a few small hands, because you're trying to redistribute them to everybody. So people who are capitalists don't like public education to be incredibly well-funded and to, you know, provide for the needs of everyone, to be provided free to everyone. They prefer education to be set up in a way that makes them money, and also in a way that, you know, turns out future workers for them and you know, puts people into debt so that they can't, you know, fight back against all of these things. So, you know, there are a small, I mean, this is the basic socialist premise, right? Is that there's a small number of people who have control of most of the stuff that we need to live. And if we, to spread the resources around equitably, you have to fight those people. You have to go up against them and defeat them, because otherwise they're going to continue hoarding all of the stuff. And, you know, the fact that we see socialism as, up until recently, a kind of dirty word, is a product of the capitalists and their, you know, political henchmen defeating socialism, right? It's a product of McCarthyism, which was about snuffing out the socialist presence in American life. And anybody who not just, you know, was a member of the Communist Party or it was a socialist of any kind, but anybody who had progressive ideals in general, I mean, McCarthyism was about pushing them out of American life and making that point of view one that is, like, not acceptable in polite company in America. So we are a unique country around the world in that up until very recently, democratic socialism was not seen as an acceptable part of our political discourse. And I think that, mercifully, that is now beginning to change, and thanks in large part to the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Right. I agree with you on that. I think that there has been a resurgence, especially with, you know, the winds of, like, AOC and now, like, the campaign for Jamal Bowman still goes on there. I heard there's a lawsuit from Elliot Engel now, but there's a lot more progressive, democratic, socialist type candidates that are taking a lead, which I think is great. And I think also, just like to kind of go back, that one thing that I've always kind of pondered is that there is already socialism in America. And I think people have talked about this before, but it's socialism for the rich, that, you know, Walmart can pay their workers such low wages because then they can go get public benefits like welfare and things like that, that the government's going to pay for. So, I mean, that's one thing that I think that, like, people may not realize, but there is already socialism for the rich and for big business. And so I think that it's not too far of a step to think of having socialism for everyday people. Am I wrong on that?
Yeah. I mean, the right and the rich like to say that they don't believe in government interference in the world, right? They want to let the free market do its thing. But the truth is that no functioning society can actually work if you don't have a government engaged in one way or the other. And what ends up, you know, the world that we now live in that was created by the right, by the ultra rich, is one in which the government assists rich people. Like one in right. which, you know, examples like you just mentioned, large employers like Walmart depending on government assistance in order to subsidize their low wages, and meanwhile, and all the stories that your listeners probably already know about how government is continually giving huge tax breaks to corporations like them, et cetera. So we're not talking about, you know, is the government intervening in our lives or not. The government is very engaged in our lives. The question is, will it be for average people, right, the vast majority of us, or for the wealthy? And yeah, you mentioned this idea that people actually could like socialism, that we could actually change the government intervention to be in our favor. And, you know, people, even people who have been raised to believe sort of like anti-socialist, anti-communist propaganda, I mean, people like their public libraries, people like public schools. You know, try dismantling the public education system in the United States. There are people on the right who are trying very hard to do this, but they're running into roadblocks of average Americans actually defending their public school system and not wanting to see it dismantled and handed over to capitalists. So people like public goods. People understand that we need to decommodify really essential public goods and you know, make them accessible and well-funded for everybody. So that, you know, it's, people are not sort of uniquely allergic to slices of socialism, even in the United States. And I think the task of socialists today is to defend those public goods where they already exist, and then encourage us to move in other directions to decommodify goods, to make them accessible to everybody, especially housing, especially healthcare, public education, and higher education, all the stuff that was, you know, the bread and butter of the Bernie Sanders campaigns. That's what we should be fighting for, to make public goods, to make them free, to make them accessible to everybody.
Right. And I did want to get into a bit on the Bernie Sanders campaign and also your book that you co-wrote. But I just have a few more questions before that. Do you think that democratic socialism will ever dominate U.S. politics? What do you think are some strategies that everyday people can help to move it along, to move it forward?
Well, we are currently in a situation which is the best one that we have been in at least half a century for democratic socialists, which is that we have, I think three now people who are members of the Democratic Socialists of America in the House of Representatives, you know, three out of 435, is it? So, you know, we're at less than 1% in the House of Representatives. So I don't want to, you know, bang the drum too early in celebration of any, you know, premature celebration of democratic socialist victory. I mean, the whole democratic socialist conception is that we believe that we can win over majorities to our politics, that we're, you know, that we're not trying to engage in, you know, like a military coup and, you know, toss Trump out onto the front lawn of the White House and declare the U.S. government now is ours. We believe exactly in using the democratic systems, you know, atrophied though it is, in order to change the world. So, you know, I wouldn't be a democratic socialist if I didn't believe that it was possible to win a majority of people over to our agenda. And we're already seeing very promising signs of that, even if there are less than 1% of members of the House of Representatives who are democratic socialists. There are very strong majorities of people who back Medicare for All. There are obviously already strong majorities of people who back public education, but also an emerging majority of people who believe that public colleges and universities should be tuition free. So I see the kind of ideas that democratic socialists are fighting for really gaining a lot of momentum in society right now. And yeah, part of the reason that we wrote the book was to try to take advantage of that moment, because we haven't had a moment like this for at least since the 1960s. And we have to take advantage of it in order to try to remake the world into something that is more just and more livable.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I'm just kind of curious too about, before we get into your book, what's a little bit of your personal history, and were you always interested in this democratic socialism movement, or have you, you know, dabbled in other things, or what's a bit of your personal history?
So I am the son of a Lutheran pastor and a paraprofessional, like a teacher's aide in public schools. Yeah. In first in Toledo, Ohio, where I was born, and then in Muskegon, Michigan, where I spent the second half of my childhood. And my parents are very progressive. I grew up with a very progressive kind of Christianity, kind of Christianity that I still identify with very strongly. But when I was a teenager, I started getting into radical politics through the punk scene in West Michigan. I played in bands, and you know, I was always in going to shows, and you know, I became a vegan, and I got into a sort of anti-consumerism. I got into stuff that was kind of dominant on the American left at that time, sort of anarchism and sort of lifestyle type politics. And I was involved in the anti-war movement in West Michigan and all kinds of progressive organizing. And I just sort of fell in with that, I think, because I had this background of progressive politics. Through college, I got involved in the labor movement. My mom was also a really active member of her teachers' union, which probably helped suffuse a little bit of concern for the labor movement to me. And, you know, at first, when I got involved in the labor movement, I sort of like swung in the exact opposite of direction of my initial anarchist politics. I as a teenager, I became an anarchist. Then I read, I don't know, Saul Alinsky, and I was like, no, actually, anybody who's serious is, I don't know, going to cut their hair and take out their earrings and like really get to hard to work, you know, be sober and not be a weirdo. So I went in this kind of like more conservative direction, conservative in like not radical left, even though I still considered myself a socialist of some kind. But then it was through Jacobin that I kind of merged the two. And I saw that, pre-Bernie 2016, I saw that radical politics could actually be talked about in a way that felt like they, it could have some purchase in society, that could actually speak to relevant concerns that are going on in the world. So I had been a union organizer for a few years, but after that, I started writing for Jacobin and then became an editor. And, Jacobin has kind of reshaped my politics to the mold of truly democratic socialist politics. And that's, I've been at Jacobin now off and on for six or seven years at this point. So, this is hopefully my final destination in terms of political development.
Yeah, it sounds like you've kind of gone through. I mean, I did the similar thing when I was younger, got into the punk scene, was playing drums in like punk bands, and really got into like anarchy too, but had come around to seeing like more movement that can be made with democratic socialism. So I was interesting to hear, a bit of your personal history. And then how did you, what's your take on the Bernie Sanders campaign? I mean, this is a loaded question, but what was your take on the Bernie Sanders campaign? And then also let's just talk about your newest book, Bigger Than Bernie, how we go from the Sanders campaign to democratic socialism.
I think that we will look back on the two Sanders campaigns as being moments that were catalysts for a long-term shift in American politics, a long-term shift away from the dominance of neoliberalism, which has been really, for both Democrats and Republicans, central since at least Ronald Reagan's first term. Perry Anderson, the Marxist theorist, called neoliberalism the most successful ideology in world history. That's certainly how it's felt for the past four decades. And we'll look at Bernie's campaign as being the moment that kind of broke the spell of neoliberalism, and that not just broke the spell of neoliberalism, but reintroduced socialism to American life. And, there are things that I would criticize about how the Bernie Sanders campaign was run. They could have done some messaging differently. They could have waited longer before he dropped out. There's many things that we could say that the campaign in 2020 didn't do well. Overall, I think that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that Sanders has accomplished a really monumental task of changing the way that we talk about politics in the United States in a way that my hunch is will long outlast him, that socialism will be around in the United States for years and decades to come in a way that it wasn't before 2016. And so I think we who are socialists and also people who are progressives generally, even people who don't identify as socialists, owe a great debt to Bernie because he has helped enlarge the sphere of political discourse in an enormous way and then moved it in a more progressive direction. We're at a time when obviously really awful people, really awful, insanely wealthy and incredibly cruel people are holding the levers of power of the universe right now. And, we shouldn't be sort of Pollyannish, and we should recognize that they are firmly the ones who are in charge right now. But we have, through the Bernie campaigns, a good sort of initial toehold to begin pushing back in the opposite direction, in a more, you know, a vision of a more humane and decent and democratic society for everybody. So that, I think, is like the top line thing that we should take away from the Sanders campaign, this really important shift in politics that will hopefully have some really long-term effects, and hopefully will continue to inspire a movement in his wake, which is what our book is about. I mean, the book is called Bigger Than Bernie. We actually only have one chapter in the book that's about Bernie himself, and the rest of it is about what the movement that has cohered after his first campaign should do from here. So, you know, we first kind of talk about his life and emphasize that he is a really important figure as an individual. You know, things would not have played out the way that they have in terms of the rebirth of the Democratic Socialist Movement without Bernie Sanders himself running for president. So we think that's important. But then we also have some ideas about how this newly born Democratic Socialist Movement should go about engaging in politics, in engaging with the labor movement, how it should see elections, how it should see the Democratic Party, and sort of where we go from here. So it's a kind of, even though we wrote it before Bernie dropped out, it's a kind of manual for where the newly reborn socialist movement goes after Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, and I'm happy to say that I purchased it, and I just wanted to ask if you could just provide, I encourage listeners to purchase it as well, but just provide maybe like one vibrant takeaway or one practical strategy that could help move democratic socialism forward.
Yeah, we have a couple of them in the book. One I'll focus on is that we talk about the sticky situation that is the Democratic Party and how we engage the Democratic Party. I think as anybody who has paid attention to Bernie's campaign knows, the people who are in the leadership positions of the Democratic Party do not have particularly strongly progressive ideals in mind in terms of their political practice. They, you know, the Chuck Schumers and the Nancy Pelosi's of the world really moved heaven and earth to try to destroy the campaign of Bernie. Who, what was Bernie arguing for? He was not wanting to establish a Bolshevik style state in the United States. He was saying we need these goods that everybody already has in wealthy countries in Europe, you know, free healthcare for everybody, free public colleges. His goals were relatively modest, and yet the Democratic Party leadership moved heaven and earth to try to destroy him. So this is a situation that we have been stuck with on the left throughout American history. It's something that lots of radicals have had to wrestle with. How do we deal with the fact that the Democrats really are not our friends, that the Democrats are a fundamentally capitalist party, and that we, because of some structural, the structure of American politics, the cards are basically stacked against us in terms of being able to create a party of our own. And that's different from, you know, Canada, which has a social democratic party, the New Democratic Party, the UK as the Labour Party, etc. And so we argue for what we call the dirty break strategy. People on the left have basically gone two ways when it comes to the Democrats in the past. They've said, okay, the Democrats are a terrible party. They are a capitalist party. And so we're going to have nothing to do with them. And we're going to create a third party that will actually be a real left party. But of course, that's never come to very much. You know, some people have mounted heroic third party campaigns, but, you know, nobody in a third party in a very long time has actually had a shot in American politics. So those efforts have been kind of, you know, drifted off into oblivion. On the other hand, there are people who said, okay, well, I don't really like the Democratic Party that much, but they're the only game in town. So these are, you know, progressives and trade unionists and socialists at times get involved in the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party ends up pulling them rightward. And their progressive ideals are basically sapped out of them. So the dirty break strategy is a strategy that is trying to avoid both of those pitfalls. It says, okay, we're going to have to engage the Democratic Party because it's the only game in town, because the cards are stacked against us if we don't. But we need to be very sober about that party. This is a party that is a fundamentally capitalist party. This is a party that doesn't want to see, at its highest levels, doesn't want to see Medicare for all, free college for all. And that contrasts greatly with the base of the Democratic Party, which is, you know, trade unionists and African-Americans and civil rights activists and feminists and environmentalists. All the people who you would want to have in a real left-wing party are stuck in this fundamentally capitalist party. So we say, you know, let's make that distinction between rank and file Democrats and the Democratic leaders, and use this party for our own purposes, basically, but be very sober about the fact that the destroy any kind of progressive political project. And the hope in doing that is to, in the long run, establish the conditions where we could eventually break from the Democratic Party. That would require a whole host of, you know, changes in American political rules and political law and all the rest of it. It's not a minor task in order to be able to achieve that. But if we're ever going to get in that direction, the road to there will be through the Democratic Party in ways like Bernie Sanders running, despite not being a Democrat, running as a Democrat for the presidential nomination. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez doesn't agree with this strategy, but she makes it very clear that she sees herself as very distinct from somebody like Joe Biden. She told a reporter recently that, you know, just so you understand, if we were in any other country, Joe Biden and I would not be in the same party. So she's sort of heightening the contradictions between the base of the Democratic Party and left-wing political figures like her on the one hand and the Joe Bidens of the world on the other. And I think that is the essential way forward in dealing with this strange situation we find ourselves in, where we're stuck without a real left-wing party in the U.S.
Right. And I know a lot of people that I know and am familiar with have also, like, as you outlined, they just are like going to break from the Democratic Party completely, go to the Green Party, or try to start a third party. And I agree with the strategy that you've outlined, because I think it is more practical and going to move the agendas we want to see forward. I personally, was just very upset about this whole 2020 campaign, but I know we can. We're brief on time, and there's a few things I want to discuss. But is there anything that you would like to talk about with the Joe Biden campaign? This campaign drives me nuts. Is there anything that you want to talk about with it?
What Joe Biden campaign?
That's exactly true.
Yeah, I mean, we're in the middle of the worst pandemic that we have seen in at least a century, if not longer. We have, you know, this absolutely, you know, addled, insane person occupying the White House. We have a whole series of crises that we're up against before the pandemic hit. And you would think that somebody who, you know, thought of himself as the guy to run against Trump would be really on the front lines of denouncing him and providing a more progressive path forward, and really speaking to the American people at a time of great crisis and uncertainty. And certainly from the left, like, be advocating for robust measures that we need to deal with this crisis, like better unemployment benefits, something more like what they're doing in Europe, where they're covering workers' salaries until the pandemic is over so that people don't all get fired from their jobs, advocating for a public health system so that, you know, everybody who now no longer has health insurance and is in danger of getting COVID-19 could, you know. He's nowhere to be found in doing any of this stuff. So I can't say I have a whole lot of hope for Biden. I mean, I guess I hope he wins. I hope he defeats Trump, but I have to wonder if he's even going to be capable of that, given how pathetic his campaigning has been at a time where it should be a slam dunk. It should be a moment when he could be on the front lines talking about how awful of a job Trump has done and why literally hundreds of people, hundreds of thousands of people are dying as a result of his inaction. And yet, you know, crickets from him. So it's pretty dispiriting, to say the least.
Yeah, and I agree. It's dispiriting. It's frustrating. All those things, and I can't even imagine what this is. What we're going to be talking about in when whoever wins the presidency. But I know we're a little short on time, so I just wanted to wrap up with a couple things. I wanted you to just talk about your podcast, and then also for people that aren't familiar with Jacobin Magazine, some things you could say about that. And then I'll have a few final questions after that.
Yeah, I have a podcast. We have a number of podcasts through Jacobin. You can find our channel. It's called Jacobin Radio. If you search Jacobin Radio, you'll find it. And I have a podcast where I mostly talk to people who've written articles for Jacobin, and I try to keep conversations pretty light, you know, cap them at half an hour and talk about an important political issue that people are wrestling with. And you know, I'm an avid podcast listener, so I know that there are lots of people who aren't reading the, you know, 50 articles a week that we're putting out at Jacobin, but are likely to listen to a half hour podcast conversation about it. So I wanted to reach those people too. And your question about Jacobin generally, we are a socialist magazine that has been around for, I believe, 9 years now. We've got a quarterly print issue, comes out every 3 months. We have we have a whole sort of spread of different kinds of media. We've got the online stuff that I am in charge of, where we're publishing 6-7 new articles every day. We have an academic journal called Catalyst. We have we have a YouTube series that we started when the pandemic started called Stay at Home, where we do political education lectures and then conversations with people in the comment section, which you can find if you search for Jacobin on YouTube. We have a documentary coming out, podcast. We have a whole range of things. And we have a book series, which is what my book was on. And we, you know, we started 9 years ago as an attempt to, before the Bernie Sanders campaign, put socialism back on the map in American politics. And I think we have been moderately successful in doing so. We, you know, we reach 2 million people a month on our website, and we've gotten a fair amount of attention. And we've done so by, you know, adhering to basic democratic socialist principles and trying to talk about them in a way that makes sense to average people. So, yeah, if your listeners aren't familiar with it, you should check it out at jacobinmag.com.
Yeah, and I'll also link to a lot of these things that we talked about in the show notes, so people can that aren't familiar with how to access some of these resources, go to them, because I definitely would encourage, if you haven't prescribed to any of the podcasts, to listen to it. It is very useful material. Wanted to, you know, see if you had any parting thoughts, and just like I always talk about books with people, so just maybe one great book that you've read recently or would recommend, and then I think we can say goodbye.
One great book that I read recently. Well, the last book that I finished, I've been doing a kind of a deeper dive on the civil rights movement in history in the United States. And I read a book called A Freedom Summer about the 1964 Freedom Summer campaign in Mississippi, which was the campaign in which three civil rights workers were murdered in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and really blew my mind and gave me a sense of perspective of how, you know, I'm part of this new democratic socialist movement today with people who are really throwing their lives into democratic socialist activism. And, you know, within my parents' lifetime, there was, you know, people like me who, as their expression of their activism, went to Mississippi, which was basically a fascist police state in 1964, a white supremacist police state in 1964, and really risked life and limb to try to end Jim Crow in Mississippi, and to some degree succeeded. So that was a kind of, you know, shocking read in terms of just how brutal conditions were in an American state not that long ago, but also inspiring to see how, you know, there was this whole social order built around white supremacy, and activists, you know, average people actually toppled that order. So it's something that at a time that's as bleak as ours, but also a time in which people are actually trying to figure out alternatives to the status quo and organizing against it. It's a useful reminder that, as the writer Mike Davis recently said, you know, miracles are possible. Miracles have been achieved in American political life. I would also just briefly mention the book, The Socialist Manifesto, by my coworker, Bhaskar Sankara, who, if your listeners are interested in a kind of, you know, less than 300 pages, a whole world history of socialism and a explanation or an argument for, you know, basic argument of where the democratic socialist movement goes from here, you can't really do better than his book. So it's called The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality.
Awesome. Thanks for those recommendations. And then where can people, or where's the best place for people to find you on the internet? And any parting thoughts?
I guess on Twitter, although I recently deleted Twitter from my phone, which I have to say was a very wise life choice. I'm just like living a utopian existence now without Twitter on my phone. I'm barely on it anymore. It's really, I would highly recommend it. But beyond that, you know, subscribe to the podcast, and you won't see my name every day, but our website, jackmanmag.com, something we put a ton of effort into, and to try to, you know, provide basic socialist analysis about what the issues of the day are. So I'd encourage people to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, and then check out what we're putting out at Jacobin every day.
Awesome. Thanks so much for all the work that you do. Thanks for taking the time out today to join the Fringe Voices podcast. And I hope you have a great rest of the day.
Great. Thanks for having me.